Especially thank you to our visitors. You may or may not be aware of how many of our members are out. Your presence is always appreciated, but when we are running at 25% capacity or something along those lines, your presence is very greatly appreciated. Such is the case today. We thank the Lord that we've been granted opportunity to come together and be together during this special time of the year, and look forward to the new year to come. I hope that your plans are good. I hope that your blessings are great and that the Lord will bless us in the new year. If you haven't already, turn to Isaiah chapter 7. And we're going to talk about a story that we find here in this passage and in connected passages. The members here are collectively groaning and saying, "Not more Isaiah, surely not more Isaiah." I freely confess, I have been obsessed with Isaiah over the last month or so. It's entirely possible that that a project is in the works. We don't have to worry about that for a few months. But at any rate, I've been spending a lot of time in Isaiah and very impressed with the work that this man did over a long, long, about a half a century or more, the good work that he did. And the implications it has for us today in the Lord's church. But particularly in context here of Isaiah chapter 7, I want to talk about Isaiah himself and the work that he was doing in his day and the impact that it had in his day. We think about the prophecy in terms of, especially this prophecy, with regard to the coming of Jesus and the blessings that we have through Jesus. And that's absolutely a part of this, and we'll be touching on that too. But Isaiah had work to do in the short term also. And what I would like to do primarily here today is talk about what I'm calling the first Emmanuel. The what's going on in Isaiah's day. His dealings with Ahaz, his family, his working among the people of his day. As they watched the northern kingdom slide deeper and deeper into depravity and ultimately into destruction. And as Isaiah prophetically saw the same thing coming for his own nation and saw Ahaz as a very real part of the problem and how he desperately sought to bring God back into the equation and help Ahaz and the rest of the nation trust in God as they ought. And he provided a sign. In fact, it was a sign very, very close to his heart. His own life, in fact, the life of his family. That was going to help flesh this out. How committed God was to his people. And how much he wanted them to be committed to him as well. At least that's the purpose of the lesson here this morning. I'll freely confess to you that this lesson was spawned and developed while surrounded by children and nieces and nephews and a rather chaotic holiday season in North Texas. And it may or may not work. I hope it does. It did when I left. It did at the time. I'll plead temporary insanity if it doesn't. Anyway, as we read earlier in Isaiah chapter 7 and verse number 10, that Ahaz is given an opportunity to receive a sign. And I'm not aware of a parallel text. There may be others that are slipping my mind. But the idea of God's man coming up to somebody and says, "Ask whatever you want, anything that you want, and God will give it to you." What would you wish for? What would you ask for? Something life-altering? Something huge? Something personal? Something that you have wanted your entire life? How about this? How about you ask for nothing? I would say, "You know what? Don't bother. I'm good. I'm good right here." And not saying that because you're so tremendously blessed. Not doing that because you already have everything that's really important, all the rest of it doesn't really matter. But because you have determined in your life that you're going to go in a course that is separate from God's will, and frankly, getting involved in God's blessings and God's welfare and God's choices and such is just not helpful. In short, you don't want what God has to offer you. How awful would that be? The first point that I would like to make in this story about Isaiah and Ahaz and Emmanuel is that when God offers, you accept. And that may seem rather fundamental to you and me. Like we would look at the story of Ahaz and say, how in the world could you possibly ask for nothing? Or you may buy into Ahaz's polite speech here. I will not test the Lord. I am firmly convinced, and I'll defend this, that Ahaz is simply speaking out of respect to a man who is an important cog in his government, somebody who he cannot afford to alienate. But in fact, he is not being respectful to God. He is not being deferential. And God's response to him through Isaiah proves this. This is not Ahaz being patient or Ahaz being unselfish. This is Ahaz being irreverent, testing the patience of God. And Isaiah says, God says through Isaiah, that I'm going to bless you anyway. You don't want a sign, I'll give you a sign anyway. And that's what Emmanuel is going to be. Emmanuel, which is interpretive, of course, as you probably are aware, God with us, or God is with us. Many Hebrew names have spiritual implications, especially the ones that begin or end with El, or the ones that begin or end with Yah, or Yah, or Jah. God generally goes by one of two names in the Old Testament. The name Elohim, which is used here, which is shortened to El. Samuel, Daniel, words of that nature. That connects the person to God at birth and throughout life. Or the words that the names that end in I-A-H or start with J-E-H. Jehoram, Jehoshaphat, or Isaiah, Hezekiah, those are the other name of God, Yahweh. And that's shortened also to Yah or Yah. These names are supposed to glorify God. At least that was the point in the beginning. Ahaz is probably short for Ahaziah, another common name. Ahaz wasn't glorifying God in that name, though. No doubt about that. So when Emmanuel, God with us, is offered, what Isaiah is saying here is that salvation is coming. God is going to come and company among his people in a special way. Now, there's a sense, of course, in which God is always present regardless of what's going on. And there is a sense in which God is always with his people when they are in a covenant relationship with him. And such was the case to a certain extent, at least, with the nation of Judah. But this was going to be a very special manifestation. That God was going to, in similar fashion to how the cloud of glory occupied the temple and the tabernacle before that, that the thunderings and the lightnings of Mount Sinai thundered down to signify the presence of God at Mount Sinai. This child was going to do that. This child was going to testify to the presence of God because he was going to be a living prophecy. And the salvation that God was offering was of a very special nature. Ahaz, if you go back and read the earlier part of chapter 7, which we're not going to do here at this point, Ahaz is concerned because of this alliance of his brethren to the north, ironically, and foreign powers that have allied themselves and threatened his borders, threatened his existence. And so he wants to go and make an alliance with foreigners. He wants to make an alliance with the Assyrians. And in fact, he's basically done so already. And that's what Isaiah is begging him to renounce. Don't go down this path. God is enough. God can protect you from two kings. God can protect you from 2,000 kings if you will trust in him. Ahaz is not inclined to do that. And sometimes God gives you enough rope to hang yourself. And we see that over and over again in the Old Testament. This time he's not going to do that. This time he's going to save Judah anyway, despite Ahaz. He's going to bring salvation. And this little boy, the text says here in verse number 15, he will know, he will eat curds and honey at the time that he knows enough to refuse good and refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. Great and tremendous and permanent victory is going to be found over these two kings that you're so terrified about. By the time this little boy grows up, by the time he achieves some measure of adulthood, this problem that you think is all-encompassing and completely incomprehensible, it's going to disappear. God's going to take care of this, with or without your help. How impressive is that for us? That God is that determined to save people from their own mistakes, from their own failures, from their own shortcomings. And how joyful should we be that we are privileged in the modern day to come into the presence of God through Emmanuel, to experience the reality of God being with us, and to hear Him promise that He will save us. Now, if we're just determined not to be saved, we have that choice. But that salvation is made available to us through Jesus. God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. This is His plan for you. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9. This is His plan for you and for me. Whether you want to be saved or not, you probably have people in your life right now who are determined to be lost. It looks by all appearances that they are trying to be lost and doing a fine job. God still loves them. God still cares for them. God still sent His Son to die for them. Now, maybe they won't be saved, but it won't be because God didn't care. It's certainly not going to be because God didn't provide them an opportunity. Jesus Christ is a salvation to all men everywhere, men and women, who will believe, who will accept Him as Lord, who will see and embrace the presence of God that is only available through Jesus Christ. And then after having received that blessing, after having received that salvation, to be ushered into a real and stable and blessing and blessed relationship. To not merely be kicked out of the family, but to be welcomed into the Father's arms. What a marvelous thing that is. This is what God with us is all about in Isaiah's day, 7 centuries before the birth of Christ. God is offering to come and be present among His people. This is what this child is going to be. If you skip ahead a little bit to chapter 8, I get to show off my pronunciation skills, or try to. Take for yourself a large tablet, God said to Isaiah here, and write on it in ordinary letters, swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. And I will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony, Uriah the priest, and Zechariah the son of Jerubbaal, or something like that. So I approached the prophetess, and presumably the prophetess is Isaiah's wife. And she conceived and gave birth to a son. Then the Lord said to me, name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz. That's swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. Or a derivative of that anyway, in Hebrew. For before the boy knows how to cry out, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. See, here's the son. Here's Emmanuel. And as this boy is born, and as this boy grows, and as he's been singled out to Ahaz, and no doubt to others as well, Isaiah is saying, watch this boy. And realize that the real and pending and assured judgment of God that is coming. As surely as this boy is alive, as surely as he was born, as surely as he continues to survive and thrive, even if he's only eating curds and honey, God has already determined in His mind to win this battle. One of our nephews, you know, looks like Tracy's dad. Maybe you have a family resemblance of that nature in your family. I remember going to my uncle's funeral and watching photographs of him as a child and his son, my cousin, as a child, and that man's son now flesh up on the screen, and it was creepy how much they looked alike. And they could have been the same person. When you're in the presence of the child, it reminds you of the father. It reminds you of the grandfather. It reminds you, and when that person is gone, you look to this new generation and you see a remnant of the old. And you're comforted to know that there is a sense in which that person lives on. They're still real. They're still here. Now, that is largely a construct of our own mind. That's our mind playing tricks with us. But there is a very real sense, not imaginary, that Isaiah and his wife, and Ahaz, if he was willing, could look at Maharshal Hashbaz and be reminded of this prophecy and be reminded of what Isaiah had told him. God is with us. Every day that this boy is with us, God is with us. What a wonderful assurance that is. And what a great assurance it is for us as we look at Jesus, the great Emmanuel. And we see the promise given on that very wonderful night to a bunch of nobodies, shepherds, that they saw angels in heaven celebrating this child and saying, among other things, peace among those with whom he is well pleased. When we understand that phrase properly. We touched on this a little bit in the previously this morning. The idea that God is well pleased with certain people. Those ones who have faith. Those ones who believe and who embrace the concept of Emmanuel. Those ones who at one point, Paul talks about this extensively in his letters, who were estranged from God, at war with God, but are at war with God no more. They have been ushered into a realm of peace. The Prince of Peace provides this for us. Because we have accepted him in trusting and obedient faith. And what a wonderful thing it is as we read the story of Jesus, not just this particular story, but every aspect of the Jesus story, Old and New Testament. And we're reminded that as long as Jesus is with us, God the Father is with us. And that we cannot go anywhere without him as if we would want to. That in our darkest hours, our loneliest moments, when we are on the verge of despair, God is with us. He comforts us. He assures us. He gives us hope that the current turmoil, the current conflict is temporary and that we can and will survive. That's the hope that he gives us. Yes, it's bad. And you know what? It's going to be bad. It may get worse. But that doesn't mean God isn't with us. God is always with us. Later on in chapter 7, as the God will whistle for the fly that is in the remotest rivers of Egypt, he says in verse number 18, God's going to call this Assyria that Ahaz put so much trust in, and they are going to make Judah miserable. It's going to be horrible. It's going to look like it is all is lost. Historians tell us that three strongholds in the southern kingdom, and that's it, survived Sennacherib, including Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was on the verge of falling too. It says in verse number 21, now in that day a man may keep alive a heifer and a pair of sheep. And because of the abundance of milk produced, he will eat curds, for everyone that is left within the land will eat curds and honey. That's the curds and honey that he's talking about back in verse number 15, that Emmanuel was going to eat. Now, if you have a heifer and a pair of sheep in the modern day, that makes you a rancher. Yeah, you're pretty advanced. That's my family used to have cattle, but they weren't really part of my life. My granddad had some sheep because he was too lazy to cut the grass. But that's it. If you are an agrarian society, if you are farmers, by your lifestyle choice, losing your farmland, losing your acreage, because when the siege comes in, they cut down everything. They burn everything. It's you take what you can and you move into the city and you just keep your hopes alive if you can. That's all. And if all you have to your name is one heifer and two sheep, you may think that disaster is coming. What it really means is You can eat a lot of cheese. I don't know how you feel about cheese. It's a 80% diet source. Kind of terrifies me. It wouldn't be my choice. It wasn't their choice. But this is what they're going to do. They're going to subsist on an abundance, in fact, of curds and honey. They're going to have plenty. Maybe not what they wanted. Maybe not what they had. But they'll have enough. God is going to sustain them through this difficult time. That is the promise. You will make it. You will suffer. Yes. You will be deprived. Yes. But you will survive. You will make it through this. And that is absolutely a message that we need to hear as we embrace Emmanuel in our life. As we welcome Jesus in and hope and pray that he will fix our life. And oftentimes he does not. And we're perplexed at that. We don't understand why we're eating the curds and honey. We don't understand why it has to be this way. Why couldn't it be better? But if we have faith, if we believe, if we truly believe that God is with us, we know that we can survive this. We know that we can push through. We know that God is blessing us. The hope that we have in Jesus, Romans 5 verse 5 says, will not disappoint. There's nothing that you are hoping for in Jesus that is founded on Scripture, that is, that will be denied to you. All the promises that God makes will be fulfilled. And if you're on the right side of His wrath, if you are in His favor, if you are living in the presence of God, it may or may not feel like that in the short term, but you can and you will be brought into prosperity. Hope remains alive. And this isn't just kind of the cross your fingers and hope for the best kind of hope. This is biblical hope. This has foundation. This is real. This is something that we expect to happen. That in fact we know will happen. Not because of our power and not because of our enemy's weaknesses. Because of the greatness of the God that is among us. Now that's the positive half of the lesson. That's the nice side. I'm going to flip the coin over for a little bit. Let's talk about something else. Having Emmanuel in your life does not always provide the comfort that you're looking for. I'm sorry to tell you that. I'm sorry that it is that way. Might be a better way of phrasing that. I'm glad to tell you that because that's what the Bible says. It may not be what you want to hear. It probably isn't what you or I want to hear. It's not what Ahaz wanted to hear for sure. And it may not have been what Isaiah wanted to hear. The fact is, living in the presence of God has its downside. Sometimes we come into the presence of God so that He can fix us. When was the last time you enjoyed a trip to the dentist? You know, or to the orthopedic surgeon, or to some other kind of person that you go to because they're an expert. And because you have a problem, and they have the tools and the experience and the wherewithal to address that problem. And you have confidence, some confidence at least, that they can help. And so you go and you subject yourself to this awful time. Chiropractors, you know, same kind of thing, right? What we won't put up with sometimes, because we believe that at the end of the day, or maybe the end of the week or the month or the year, we're going to be better. That's what God does. That's what coming into the presence of God sometimes is like. Having Emmanuel in their life, in the life of Judah, in the 8th century B.C., meant the rise of the most despicable and horrible and bloodthirsty nation the planet had ever seen. The Assyrians were horrible. Killing for sport. Disgusting, awful people. And they served God's plan. God brought them up. God brought them to His people. Why in the world would He do that? Well, in the moment, God's people probably didn't understand. Verse number 5 in Isaiah chapter 8. Again, the Lord spoke to me further, saying, inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh, and rejoice in reason, and the son of Remaliah, that's the two kings that we were talking about before. Now, therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and will rise up over all its channels and go over all its banks. Then it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck, and the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Can you imagine Isaiah explaining this to his son? Your life is going to be awful for a while, and God's making it awful. You, Emmanuel, the one who God is with, the one who symbolizes God's presence among his people, is going to bring down this awful, awful era. You don't like this flowing, beautiful stream of fresh water that God's trying to give? Well, I'll bring you the Euphrates River. It'll wash in and it'll wipe away everything that you know. This is what God's presence means for them. But it's going to make it better. It may not feel better. In fact, I pretty much guarantee it won't feel better. And some of you have gone through this. Maybe all of us to a certain degree have. That God is trying to work something in us, trying to get us someplace better, someplace nobler, someplace more holy. And it's going to involve this horrible process. It's going to cost you the thing that you think you cannot live without. And that's what God takes. Because he knows that he has to break you before he mends you. I hear this is a thing. I don't get it. I'm not a doctor. But I've heard that sometimes a situation may be with an athletic injury or something like that, where a person is so hurt, so damaged, that it is actually advantageous to break their bones. Have you heard about this? They will deliberately break the bone and reset it so that it'll go the right way. Left to itself, it won't work very well. But if it'll do a little bit more damage, then maybe it'll come to a point of healing. The human body is a mystery, certainly to me, anyway. But being broken can be a good thing. Pick up the reading, verse number 9. Be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear, all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Gird yourself, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for God is with us. There it is again. God's going to keep you from getting what you want. Why would he do that? Because he wants something better than that. Because he is trying to fix you. He's trying to bring you into a greater and more real place of spiritual health and healing. This is what Jesus does. We don't come to Jesus and lay down terms. We don't come to Jesus and negotiate. We come to Jesus and surrender everything. And say, Jesus, you can do whatever you want with me. And I trust, I believe, that at the end of the day, I'll be what I want, because what I want is what you want. And I can't get there without you. That's what God coming into our life is going to mean. And if this is a rude awakening to somebody out there, I apologize for that. But I don't apologize for what the Bible says on this. Jesus says over and over and over again that this is going to be the case. We could run all kinds of references. That the lifestyle that you choose, by the very nature of things, is going to be the lifestyle that you cannot have. His lifestyle is going to be different from what you want. And the solutions that we offer to the problems that we perceive ourselves having oftentimes wind up being the problems themselves. That's what Ahaz did. Ahaz saw the same political reality that Isaiah did. But his solution was to become more idolatrous, become more rebellious, give less respect to the God of his ancestors. That's what we will do oftentimes in our dedication to try to keep our kids off of drugs or to try to get them to graduate college or whatever. Usually it's about the kids. We are so determined, so devoted to this process, that we will embrace things that are absolutely antithetical, counterindicated to the will of God. Instead of simply trusting in Him and going where He is taking us, we trust our own instincts instead, and we make the problem worse instead of making it better. What we have to do is surrender any kind of notion that we may have already developed in our lives, in our heads, in our minds, about what the good life is. Jesus says that life is forfeit. You have to give it up. We've read from Luke chapter 9 many, many times. Read it one more time. Luke 9, verse number 23. And He was saying to them all, or if you prefer, saying to us all, if anyone wishes to come after Me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow Me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for My sake, he is the one who will save it. Please take Jesus at His word here. I realize that your idea of the good life is sweet and wonderful, and you want it more than anything. But if you can bring yourself to want Jesus more, if you can bring yourself to want God to be with you, even more than that thing, whatever it happens to be, fame, money, popularity, whatever. If you can want God to be with you more than anything else, and if you can bring yourself to surrender that thing that is keeping you from having true and real and lasting fellowship with Him, then you can, in fact, have absolutely everything that God has for you. Now, I'm not talking about money here. I'm not talking about physical things. I'm talking about every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. Ephesians 1, verse 3. And plenty of the other stuff too, probably. But mainly we're talking about spiritual things. This only comes when God is with you. Embracing a different reality, embracing a different life, can only lead to failure. The discomfort that we feel in this process, the pain, the hardship, the loss that we feel while this is happening, while God is working His way with us, this is not a reflection on God. This is a reflection on us. If you're in some kind of physical therapy and you know, your doctor says you need to do this with your arm, and you say, I can't do that with my arm, it's going to hurt. He says, do it anyway. And you do it anyway, and what do you know? It hurt. It hurt a lot. And so you stop doing it. No, you got to keep doing that. I don't want to keep doing it. You got to keep doing that. The problem is not with the doctor. The problem is with your arm. The discomfort is not the doctor's fault. The discomfort is your fault. There's no point in blaming the doctor. When we are suffering in the spirit because God is trying to have His way with us and we don't care for that, and we want Him to stop, it's not because God is asking too much out of us. It is because we are not asking enough out of ourselves. And so we push through the pain. We trust that this is right, that God would not ask of me something that is unreasonable, something that is painful and hurtful to me in the long term. It will be better if I trust in Him and go where He tells me to go. If you can do that, I promise you, and more importantly, God promises you, there will be peace at the end. Doctors make mistakes. Human beings make mistakes. You may do absolutely everything that your doctor, your therapist, or whatever tells you to do, and it does not, in fact, get better. And it's not your fault, it's His fault. That does happen sometimes. It will not happen with God. If you will submit to Him, if you will truly say, have Thine own way, Lord, have Thine own way. I am the potter. Thou art the clay. Mold me and make me after Your will, while I am yielded and still. Well, if we will just allow Him to work with us, yes, it may hurt. It may hurt a lot. But at the end of the day, and even in the middle of the day, even while the pain is there, there is peace. Because you know that the solution is in the works, that you are getting where you want to be. People who are on diets and exercise regimens, trying to lose the extra 20 pounds, all the pumpkin pie that you're eating over the holidays, trying to get rid of that. It hurts to do that. You don't like doing that, but you feel really good about doing that. You feel good about the pain because you know you're on the right track. This is what the peace of God that passes all understanding is all about. Even when it hurts, even when being in the presence of God is painful to us, we rejoice in it. We are at peace with it because we know that we want more than anything else for God to be with us. And if we will do this, then He will be with us. What a wonderful, wonderful assurance that is. The reason that it doesn't work is because we are flawed in our application. Because we are trying to have our way instead of having His way. Jesus talks about money in Luke 16:13. It could be anything. But money generally represents physical things, carnal things, fleshly things. You cannot serve God and mammon, He says. You cannot serve God and money. No man can serve two masters. If you will determine to serve the one master, allow Him to guide you. Instead of pushing back, then that relief, that comfort, that healing is going to come much faster. It's going to be more complete. And you're going to rejoice even more. And wish you'd started the process sooner. Because being in the presence of God is the greatest thing that could possibly be. Don't try to ride the fence. I always thought that was a weird expression. I can't imagine something more uncomfortable and awkward and ultimately flawed than riding a fence. Why would you want to do that? It's what Elijah said to the people back in his day. How long are you going to halt between two opinions? Make a decision. And if you make a decision for God, then embrace that decision, live with that decision, rejoice in that decision, suffer occasionally, yes, in that decision. But hope in that decision. Know that God is guiding you and carrying you through every aspect of it. Ushering you into a reality, a spiritual reality that is wonderful in this life and that is only a foretaste of what waits for you after this life is over. That's what Emmanuel means to me. And it's what I hope that it means to you. If you're ready to accept the presence of God in your life, if you're ready to embrace Him and His ways, regardless of what it may cost you, regardless of what you may have to give up or embrace that you may not be inclined to do, please accept the invitation that God offers you this morning. To come to Him, to trust in His Son, Jesus Christ, to put Jesus on in baptism, to have your sins washed away, so that you can live your life in the style that He has always intended for you. What you were born to do, what you were born to live, you can be that this very day. It won't necessarily be easy. In fact, I assure you it won't be easy. And it'll occasionally hurt. You may even question whether it was a good idea, but it was the best idea you ever made. And at the end of the day, you'll realize that, and you'll rejoice in that. Because you get to go to heaven when you die. If there's anything we can do to help you in your spiritual pursuit of spiritual things, please respond at this time while we stand and sing to encourage you.